A messy Middle East today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Tensions rise between Israel and Iran on several fronts.
Every day we're looking at combustible situations, and you really don't have any diplomatic solution on the horizon for any of these conflicts.
Plus, a former CIA director on why some of his friends voted for Trump.
The winds of globalization have been at my back for 50 years. And for many of my old friends, the winds of globalization have been in their face and no one has seemed to care.
Plus, a Yemeni island with a unique tree.
I can only describe it as like an umbrella. You have these tightly packed in branches and a dome of green on top. And they're thousands of years old. But the weirdest thing about them...
Hang on, you'll find out ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's good to have you with us this Thursday. So much to get to today on the show. We'll hear from a Pakistani-American Muslim asking Jewish settlers tough questions in the West Bank. And we'll chat with former CIA director Michael Hayden about truth, post-truth, and why he supports Gina Haspel. We start, though, trying to connect the dots from President Trump's decision to back out of the Iran nuclear deal to Israeli airstrikes on Iranian targets in Syria. A lot packed into that one sentence. First of all, is there a connection? I asked Joyce Karam to weigh in. She's Washington correspondent for the Emirati newspaper, The National.
Marco, it's been very tense 48 hours on the Syrian-Israeli border. We've seen Israel strike inside Syria almost 20 minutes after Mr. Trump left the nuclear deal. We saw missiles being fired on the Golan Heights last night, and then Israel retaliated again. So in total, we've seen maybe around more than 30 missiles fired back and forth between Syria and Israel. This is the biggest escalation since 1973. To your question, if this is related to the nuclear deal, the tension has been there for a long time. The Israelis have been talking about Iranian presence in the area for almost a year or more now. They've sought Russia's help in mediating this. It didn't work. And now we're seeing them taking military action. The timing could be related to the nuclear deal. Still, however, I think neither side wants a full-fledged war in that sense. And we're seeing things slowly get back to normal. Today, it's as if everybody said, okay, we've done our part, we've sent our message, and now we can just restore some kind of calm on that border.
Yes. So with Trump's announcement on Tuesday, what would you say now is, I mean, Israel had a huge stake in what he was going to say. What is Israel's objective right now vis-a-vis Iran?
For Israel, the priority has been for a while now ensuring that Iran is not cornering Israel from two borders, from South Lebanon and now from Syria on the Golan Heights. And that's a security priority for them. They've been trying to speak to the Russians. We've seen Prime Minister Netanyahu was just in Moscow. So in that sense, having Iranian proxies on its border is a red line. And what we've seen in the last 48 hours could become the new normal. I mean, I've been covering the region for some time now, and I've never seen that many attacks. This is at least 5 rounds of strikes in 1 month carried out by Israel and Syria targeting Iranian military assets. So we're definitely entering a new phase in the war. The nuclear deal is one aspect of it. It provides Iran with ammunition that they want to retaliate. But on the larger scale, the Syria situation is a very combustible element in and by itself. So all in all, this is a very tense situation.
But Joyce, you also seem to have the sense that the various sides don't really have the appetite for full-scale war right now. What gives you that optimism, given that tension?
Because I think everybody would lose in an open war. Iran is not now in a position to wage full-scale traditional military war against Israel. Instead, it uses militias. For Israel, military strikes, targeted strikes to secure its border have been an enough deterrent. We've seen the Lebanese border has been relatively very peaceful since 2006. So I'm not sure Israel wants also an open war at the moment. Full-scale war would, I think, threaten these gains.
Joyce, if you pull way back and look at the Mideast as a whole, I mean, this has been a very busy week, a lot of news. What is your big kind of overriding concern right now?
One concern is just the escalating tension that any miscalculation could happen and draw us into a regional war. Every day we're looking at the combustible situations, whether in Yemen, whether in Iraq, in Syria, or to a less extent in Lebanon. And you really don't have any diplomatic solution on the horizon for any of these conflicts.
That was Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for the UAE newspaper, The National. When President Trump decided to pull the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear agreement, he also decided to reimpose economic sanctions on Tehran. And that's already affecting companies with business interests in Iran. For example, Airbus and Boeing are set to lose billions of dollars worth of orders from Iranian airlines. Stephen Mufsin of The Washington Post says Boeing is better placed to ride out the storm than its French counterpart.
Boeing was never 100% counting on this. It didn't book the planes in its logs, and it has a very healthy several-year-long log of airplane sales that it's busy with right now. So I think you saw relatively little impact on Boeing's share price, although obviously had the sale been allowed to go through, that would have been a very beneficial thing for the company. Airbus, however, did book some of those sales. It's already delivered three aircraft.
Right.
So it's very much in a different place, hoping that this deal would hold.
What was the reaction from Airbus?
Well, Airbus has been relatively quiet, but the French government's been very active in trying, both before and after the decision, trying to influence what Trump would do. And it's not just France and Airbus. The U.S. ambassador to Germany said that any German company doing business with Iran should wind that down immediately. And there are over 100 German companies with people actually in Iran, and there are thousands more that do business with Iran in one way or another. So Germany is also upset about this turn of events and had tried in vain to get Trump to reach a different conclusion.
Right, and I've seen numbers as high as 10,000 German firms doing business with Iran. Do you see all of this having greater impact on European business than on the U.S.? And are we looking, therefore, at commercial and political tensions between the U.S. and Europe, even if those businesses don't violate sanctions?
Yes. Some of the biggest of those companies are involved in the oil industry. The French oil giant Total had signed a deal to invest $2 billion, just for starters, developing a natural gas field. There are other companies out there, too. I believe Novartis has an office in Iran. There are automobile companies in Europe that are doing business with Iran, trying to revive that part of the economy, because so many parts of the Iranian economy have been starved over the last, say, 20, 30, 40 years. The delivery by Airbus of those three planes were the first new planes for Iran Air in 23 years.
One of your specialties, Stephen, is energy. What's going to happen if Iran can't sell its oil openly? Are motorists here around the world facing an expensive summer?
Well, I think they will be facing a more expensive summer than they have in the past. Iran is not the only factor, but it is one. Most oil experts expect that the amount of oil it will be able to sell will drop by anywhere from 300,000 to 500,000 barrels a day. That's not gigantic in the global oil market, but it's significant. And the oil markets tend to be very sensitive to what's happening right at the margin.
And if Iran can't sell its oil openly, I mean, what will that do to the Iranian economy?
No question. Oil is still the most important factor by far in the Iranian economy. So it's very important to Iran to keep those sales going. And it will try everything it can do to try to keep those sales going. They've done this before. They've sent tankers without insurance to try to transfer cargo from one tanker to another to disguise where it's coming from. There are various things that Iran did in the past and will try again in the future to keep those sales going. And I think they'll have a lot of success potentially in places like China, India, Turkey. These are the biggest customers that Iran has, or among the biggest customers. And most of them probably aren't that keen to fall in line with the United States sanctions policy. So I think it's going to be tough to enforce some of those sanctions, and we'll have to see what happens.
Stephen Mufsin there of The Washington Post. The Iran nuclear deal and the dialogue it had started had given some hope to American families who have loved ones in prison in Iran. Under the deal, diplomatic channels had opened up that, at least in theory, could have helped win the detainees' freedom. But with the U.S. abandoning the agreement, the families are now scaling back their hopes. Ibi Caputo has more.
In some ways, it was a relief for Huachu when President Trump announced the United States withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. She had been closely watching the news.
To wait for his speech, to wait for that uncertainty to fall down on the ground, to be settled, so that I can think through what I shall do going forward.
Chu's husband, Xiu Wang, has been imprisoned in Iran for nearly 2 years. He's an American citizen and a graduate student at Princeton. He was doing archival research in Tehran when he was arrested and charged with espionage. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison.
It's very worrisome. He's still doing badly there. He's in a half underground, overcrowded cell, which is heavily infested by bed bugs. So it is very difficult for him.
Chu says it's also difficult for her and her 5-year-old son.
And I can see that my son has been affected by this. It is extremely, extremely difficult for me to still be composed, to be a single working mom, and at the same time be the campaign manager for my husband's case.
According to the advocacy group Center for Human Rights in Iran, Xiu Wang is one of 5 U.S. citizens being imprisoned in Iran. A 6th U.S. citizen, a former CIA agent, is also missing. Now that a major diplomatic channel to Iran has been closed, it's unclear if or how negotiations will proceed for the prisoners' release.
My deep concern is that by withdrawing from the nuclear deal, we're leaving them behind.
Jason Rezaian writes for The Washington Post. He also spent 544 days imprisoned in Iran. He was released in a prisoner swap in January 2016. He says we need to get more comfortable calling these cases hostage takings.
The onus is on the Iranian regime for doing that. At the same time, the American administration, whichever American administration in power, has a responsibility to protect and to help its citizens abroad. And this is one of those situations where, you know, I don't see it as being as much of a part of the conversation as it was, for example, when I was being detained by Iran. I mean, it became a part of the Republican talking points for months, that, you know, you can't enter into this deal while Americans are still being held there. Well, you shouldn't exit that same deal while Americans are still there.
At a press conference yesterday in D.C., Babak Namazi, a relative of 2 of the Americans imprisoned in Iran, said he met with 2 high-level White House officials that morning to talk about his brother and father. He said he was assured that his family and the other detained Americans are being treated as a high priority. He also said he's thrilled for the families of the 3 Americans who were released from North Korea yesterday, but he's crushed his own brother and father aren't also free. Hyuachu says she's also happy for the families of the freed prisoners from North Korea.
It is very encouraging. President Trump has brought to the most difficult party to the bargaining table, which normal, conventional diplomats may not be able to do so. I really hope there will be a breakthrough in my husband's case. I really need him to come back to support me.
From Evin prison in Tehran, Wang is allowed to make regular phone calls to Chu. When he called yesterday morning, Chu told him about the men released from North Korea. She says the news made them both cry. For The World, I'm Ibi Caputo.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It was pretty remarkable. The People's Choice became the new prime minister of Armenia this week. He is Nikol Pashinyan. In recent weeks, Pashinyan guided the country through a series of massive peaceful protests that were dubbed a Velvet Revolution. Those protests forced the resignation of Armenia's former president, Serge Sargsyan. He'd been in power for a decade as president and was trying to extend his rule by becoming prime minister. But then came that Velvet Revolution.
Apparently, it was a surprise to every single Armenian expert.
That's Grigor Atanasian. He's a Fulbright scholar at the University of Missouri, where he covers Armenia.
Armenia somehow managed to develop a pretty vibrant civil society, even under this authoritarian rule. So when Sargsyan just tried to, you know, smoothly slide into his new position and rule indefinitely, Armenians just said no. And they took to the streets, and I want to stress that it were people of all backgrounds right. and ages. It wasn't like the liberal elite, which was mostly behind anti-Putin protests in Russia this week, for example, this weekend. It were people, you know, working class people, back-to-back to startup entrepreneurs and designers and architects and all this kind of stuff.
Why the name Velvet Revolution? Was this a revolution?
The name Velvet Revolution comes from the idea of it being a peaceful revolution, just like a Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia was.
Right.
And it's unique. Look, Marco, it's a revolution which forced a long-time authoritarian ruler to resign. It was a very, very corrupted sort of mafia state. But then they put him out peacefully in a matter of 2 weeks, and then they got people's candidate, this new opposition figure who transformed himself from a marginal sort of opposition figure to a political phenomena unlike anything Armenia has ever seen, perhaps the most popular politician in its independent history.
So it sounds like Pashinyan's really going to have to kind of produce at this point. And I know you've written about the importance of holding Pashinyan accountable as a leader. What does that actually look like, holding him accountable?
It's, in my opinion, what led to this popular movement, a revolution, it was the increased citizens' participation in politics. And we need to think of the ways how we can hold Pashinyan and his government accountable, but yet not to chill the citizens' participation, this increased interest, heightened interest to politics. And he already made a lot of promises, and perhaps one which we can see if he's going to keep up to his promise. He said that more women need to be included in governance, in state structures, and he sort of said that it was amazing how many women participated and were involved in this movement and that we need more. And he said that women are the most powerful factor in the stable development of Armenia. So we can see how many women will be in his cabinet, in his new government.
And instead of violence, I mean, I didn't see really any violence reported. There was singing and dancing. And then I saw this tweet from someone named Karina Avedisian. A revolution is when the cop who's arrested you 3 times in the past poses for a selfie with you. Does that pretty much sum up for you the tone of this revolution?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm really surprised by what happened. And people just didn't have any kind of hatred or violence. They wanted the old corrupted government to go, but they wanted to do it in a peaceful way, and they didn't want to hurt anybody. And I'm learning in a way that sometimes seeing, you know, not as a journalist, but, you know, as a citizen, as an Armenian, seeing in positions of power people who committed crimes, who are connected to murderers and mobsters, I would feel some kind of, you know, hatred or resentment. But we didn't see any of that during this protest. It was very, very peaceful. And once again, I feel like love and solidarity. These are the good words to describe what happened.
Grigor Atanasian is a Fulbright scholar at the University of Missouri in Columbia. He covers Armenia. Grigor, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Next month, kickoff, the Men's World Cup soccer tournament gets underway in Russia. Teams from 32 countries will be competing. The U.S. failed to qualify this time. Same with China. But if Xi Jinping gets his way, that will change soon. China's leader loves soccer, or football as much as the rest of the planet calls the sport, and Xi has set a goal for China to win the World Cup by 2026. by the year 2050. The Chinese women's team, by the way, has a better chance of doing that than the men. Anyway, Xi's push to raise China's soccer level is impacting lives all across the country. My BBC colleague Celia Hatton witnessed that at a small school in China's Gansu province.
It's just after 6 in the morning, but 40 children have already begun football practice at the Zhonglian Chuan Primary School high in the mountains in western China.
This tiny school is dominated by football. There are just 65 pupils, but 4 football teams. The children wake up at 5:40 a.m. to begin practice on this windy mountaintop. At the center of it all, the school's headmaster, Ma Anwu, who doubles as the main football coach.
I don't think it's too tough. Let them taste a bit of bitterness when they are young, and then they can taste the sweetness of the fruit when they are older.
These children and their families are hoping that a future in football will be their ticket out of the mountains and the grinding poverty on display here. So they keep training, even in winter when temperatures can drop to minus 20, hoping to attract the attention of football scouts. The school is doing surprisingly well. It's already sent 6 children to China's top football academy on full scholarships. 2 of its graduates are playing in China's Professional Football Super League. And now this remote primary school's become a state-approved model for the rest of China. And these children do seem happy. The captain of the girls' football team, 12-year-old Wang Chun, is in her tracksuit all the time. She also wears the Communist Party red scarf that so many children here do.
My happiest moment of the day is when we do the football training in the afternoon. I sweat it out and it feels awesome.
And if she didn't go to this school?
I wouldn't be as happy as I am now.
Wang Chun's getting ready to go out into the world. She's got a week-long trial at one of China's top football academies, Evergrande, in China's southern Guangdong province, over 2,000 kilometers away. Her elder sister's already there. At the school in Gansu's mountains, there's a special treat. Squeezed around a TV set, the headmaster and about 20 students are watching China's women's team take on the Philippines. Stand up, the headmaster orders, and they join in the national anthem before kickoff. Wang Chun looks tired. She has, after all, been awake since before 6 in the morning, and it's now past 9 at night. But even now, she's watching the game intently, looking for things to help her improve. After leaving Gansu, we learn that Wang Chun's football trial at the fancy academy down south has been postponed. That means she'll officially graduate from her primary school before she knows where her future lies. No doubt a frustrating development for a girl eager for a bright new future.
The BBC's Celia Hatton reporting there from Western China. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. A Pakistani-American Muslim writer visits Jewish settlements in the West Bank asking tough questions. Now he's getting hate from all sides.
I am your official unicorn radical Islamist Zionist faith-washing Trojan horse who at night moonlights as a gateway to jihad.
A conversation with Wajahat Ali. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I can't tell you if President Trump's nominee to lead the CIA will be confirmed. Gina Haspel faces a lot of skepticism in the U.S. Senate on both sides of the aisle. But I can say this. We're going to be hearing a lot more about Haspel ahead of the Senate's vote on her nomination, especially about her role in the enhanced interrogation program the CIA developed after 9/11. Some say it was a torture program. We'll get into that in just a moment with retired General Michael Hayden. He's a former director of the National Security Agency and the CIA, and he has a new book out called The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. In it, Hayden writes about what he calls President Trump's, quote, routine distance from the facts. I asked Hayden if he thought his concerns about the president were getting through to Trump supporters.
I don't know, because the president's approach to both
making decisions and explaining decisions is not fact-based, and he is product, not creator, of a broader trend inside American society. So that really is the issue of the book and the reason I wrote it, in terms of describing to America how it is we are changing and whether or not we can survive that change.
Yeah, I mean, with 63 million votes, I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there who actually see you as one of the players in Trump's proverbial swamp. So even if your book does make it to Trump supporters, do they want to hear what anybody in Washington has to say?
Great question. So that's why I drove back to my native Pittsburgh and had my brother Harry fill the back end of a sports bar last August with about 40 Trump supporters, most of whom I knew and had grown up with, and said, hey, what are you people thinking? And we had a really good 2+ hour conversation in which I really tried hard to understand their motivation. And frankly, it was, I go to work, I go to church, I send my kids to school, I join the PTA, I volunteer, I pay my taxes, and no one's paying attention to me. Why is that? And so I did try to develop an appreciation for the kinds of Americans that voted for President Trump, even though I viewed him to be in some ways dangerous.
I'm just curious, what was your takeaway after that sit down with those Trump supporters just about how they see the truth?
The winds of globalization have been at my back for 50 years. And for many of my old friends, the winds of globalization have been in their face and no one has seemed to care.
In your earlier book, Playing to the Edge, you defended U.S. officials who had performed waterboarding and maintained that it worked, those officials maintaining that it worked. And you say in your new book that you're not calling for the return of torture, but I'd like to know whether you still defend those people who said torture worked.
I defend the people in the agency who conducted the enhanced interrogation program, and sorry for using the indirect euphemistic language, but that's what we describe. But we don't concede that the techniques that we were authorized to use by the Department of Justice met the definition of torture, which is a very contentious statement, I understand, but I'm trying to reflect the reality that the officers were working under at the time.
So let's get into what's been going on this week with the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on Gina Haspel's nomination to lead Central Intelligence. She was asked by two different senators, if President Trump gave you a direct order to waterboard, what would you do? And her response was, I don't believe the president would ask me to do that.
Right.
Is it hard for you to imagine President Trump asking the head of the CIA to waterboard a detainee in 2018?
Right. So despite the campaign rhetoric, which I took offense to and write about in the book about waterboarding and worse because they deserve it, and I decomposed that statement on all levels, I am absolutely convinced Gina Haspel will never do it. And let me tell you why. Not because she or I am repudiating the agency's past. I am telling you we will not repeat it. More importantly, Gina will not repeat it. Let me tell you why she will never do it. Because we did this on behalf of the American people. We thought it was a reflection of what the nation wanted us to do at that time. We thought the nation or the administration or the political class had our back. They did not. As administrations changed, agency officers were hung out to dry, put through legal processes. No serious CIA director would direct his or her officers to go out and do this again with that historic experience. Gina has too much love for the agency and the people who serve her to make them vulnerable one more time. So I'm fond of saying that, you know, when the president says something not related to reality and everyone else in the room goes into what I call north-south autobob and say, you're right, boss, Gina Haspel is the woman I want in the room to stand up and say, Mr. President, a private word, because I know she will.
Haspel was also asked by several senators why all the documents relevant to her nomination were not declassified, a sort of blanket declassification, as you know, has happened plenty of times in the past when there is a strong public right to know. So why not now?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure we crossed the threshold of a strong public right to know. What we have is the agency telling the people on the Senate Intelligence Committee all they need to know. What it is they want to do is to be able to make it public. And I'm not totally convinced that that's always accompanied by the most noble of motives. And so these are the people who vote. In a democratic representative government, we entrust our elected representatives with making some choices for us. And the intelligence committees were created back in the 70s with the clear knowledge that you cannot conduct espionage by plebiscite. And so we set up select committees who would make these decisions on our behalf while still protecting legitimate secrecy. This is just the latest turn of that wheel.
Doesn't this set a dangerous precedent, though, when you don't declassify documents related to such an important position as head of Central Intelligence? I mean, are all hearings going to be basically semi-secretive at this point?
Oh, no, of course not. And an awful lot about this program has already been declassified.
Haspel is at the head of the declassification, though.
Well, I understand that, but I just said legitimate American secrets.
The destruction of evidence does raise concerns about Haspel, and it also echoes what we as citizens can know and what the government and some officials in the government know. So let me ask you this. When the CIA and NSA and FBI all say that Russia played a role in the 2016 election by carpeting social media with various ideas and narratives and memes about the candidates and America, and the president says it's not true and the rest of it is all a witch hunt, what do you think that's done to public confidence in the intelligence services?
Yeah, you come to a really important question and, frankly, a core area of the book. When the president attacks these institutions because he doesn't like what they're saying or doing, he, number one, makes life very difficult for the leaders, which has a real human toll. But he also erodes not just the institutions but the public's confidence in these institutions. And I view that as the greatest danger we face now. These immediate issues are important. What did the Russians do? Did anybody help them? They're important. More important is the preservation of these broader institutions that have served us for decades, if not centuries, in terms of our own self-government. And here I'm talking about FBI, Department of Justice, the intelligence community, and so on.
So where do you think this split between American intelligence services, which you believe deal in reality, and the president, who often doesn't, where is this going to take the U.S. government and ultimately what the people, the citizens, believe is real and not real?
Great question. And that basic issue is us and how we make decisions. And we've drifted in towards this post-truth culture in which tribalism trumps, no pun intended, data. And that actually flies in the face of the Enlightenment values that have governed Western civilization since the 17th century.
General Hayden, have you imagined what it'd be like briefing President Trump on, you know, all the stuff that you used to brief the presidents on?
I have on occasion, and I think I would find it difficult. Look, to be fair to the president, he is the way God made him. He's instinctive. He has an almost preternatural confidence in his own a priori narrative of how the world works and so on. Well, here's a better way of putting it. Michael Gerson used to write George W.'s speeches. He's his best writer. And Michael says President Trump lives in the eternal now. He doesn't appreciate much history. He doesn't consider many consequences. And the essence of intelligence is context. And now you have a summary of the issue briefing this president. He just doesn't naturally trend in the direction of that which it is we are designed to offer.
So do you think you'd have the patience?
H.R. McMaster tried. H.R. probably has a lot more patience than I do, and it didn't work.
General Michael Hayden, former director of the National Security Agency and the CIA, his new book is called The Assault on Intelligence. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Our next story features something called a dragon's blood tree, and we hear it's a sight to behold.
I can only describe it as like an umbrella. You have these tightly packed in branches and a dome of green on top, and they're thousands of years old. But the weirdest thing about them...
Yeah, we'll get to the weirdest thing in a second. Dragon's blood trees are found on an island off the coast of Yemen called Socotra. The island is part of Yemen, but Socotra has increasingly been occupied by a Yemeni ally, the United Arab Emirates. But both governments accuse each other of lying about, or at least misunderstanding, what's happening on the island. And it's gotten pretty tense on Socotra this week. Multimedia journalist Lucy Towers traveled there last month, so we asked her about events on the island and about those dragon's blood trees.
The weirdest thing about them, or what makes them maybe so special and gives them the name dragon's blood, is that the sap is crimson. And it's been used for hundreds of years by those living on the island for medicine, paint, makeup, varnish, and you see these dotted around the island. And with every turn of the road, you see these trees looming up.
You didn't go to Socotra, though, to admire exclusively the wildlife and the flora and fauna. Why go now?
Yeah, you're right. That wasn't the reason why we decided to go. Really, it's that Socotra has become ever more important in Yemen's conflict. And there's been rumours for a couple of years that the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, is on the island. They've started investing in the island. They admitted in 2017 that they've got a military presence on the island. So we really wanted to know, are these rumours true? Is the UAE trying to take control of the island?
So how did the United Arab Emirates end up in Socotra in the first place?
The UAE came as a part of a humanitarian effort after two devastating hurricanes. There were two back-to-back at the end of 2015. And, you know, Yemen's government were preoccupied with the conflict on the mainland. So the UAE stepped in and they started rebuilding on the island, and they built schools, hospitals, women's centres, roads, and more recently an extension to the port. And, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing because this island is poor and it needs development, and the UAE were willing to invest there. And if you talk to people on the island, they're really open about that. They show us the UAE flags on houses, on government buildings, on the port. There's the UAE flag flying. So people know that they're here. It's just in what capacity they're here. Are they here to really help the island, or are they here to kind of take control?
Right. So what was the range of opinions from Socotra, as you spoke with, about why they think the UAE is there?
You really have a divide on the island between those who have welcomed the Emirates and see that the island needs development. There's that tension between this and with wanting to stay part of Yemen. It's a more complicated picture because people on Socotra do not want to be drawn into the war in Yemen.
I mean, it's a remote place. As you say, it's hard to get to. How aware were most of the Socotras about what was going on just off their island, the war in Yemen, all that stuff?
I think Socotras do feel it quite acutely. We talked to a lot of people about tourism, for example, on the island. And, you know, before the war broke out in 2015, there were around about 5,000 to 6,000 tourists visiting Socotra every year. Since then, you walk along the main street in Hadibo, the capital, and tourist centres, they've all but shut up shop. Nothing's open. There's two hotels on the island. There's a tourist shop that sells souvenirs, and the souvenirs have dust all over them. I don't know who last bought anything from them, but they were really pleased to see us.
So you were shooting video. I know you also shot stills. How many stills were you did you end up by shooting?
Too many.
Incredible place. Yeah.
Too many. I mean, it's the only place that I've ever been in the world where, you know, I've seen sand dunes and these wide valleys and mountain ranges, coral reefs, and this amazing biodiversity, this flora and this fauna that you can't see anywhere else on Earth.
What is the risk that these Socotras, these people and their beauty could be dragged into the war in Yemen?
Socotras are very, very protective. Protective over their ecosystems. They've really lived in harmony with it for hundreds of years. So there are a lot of concerns with some of the island's plants. The dragon's blood tree, for example, these plants are not allowed to be taken off the island. So yeah, there are real fears there. We felt from islanders that they were under threat. It's such a complicated story because, as I said, you've got all these different actors, all this misinformation. So you really want to go and you really want to
Right.
see it for yourself because there are so many rumors and you never know really who to believe. So the best way to go and see it is to go.
You can see what Lucy Tower saw. We've posted her photos from Socotra, including some of the famous dragon's blood trees. They're all at PRI.org. So what would happen if a Pakistani-American Muslim writer began wandering around Israeli settlements on the West Bank, asking difficult questions? Writer Wajahat Ali decided to find out, in part, he says, to make a point about who can cover the story of Jewish settlements.
Oftentimes when you talk about extremists or fundamentalists from any side, usually people who look like me with my name are not the protagonists of that story. Usually it's a white guy who goes and talks about extremists. But rarely does a person of my ethnicity or religion, unfortunately, get to be that storyteller because we're oftentimes seen as being too subjective, too emotional, too reactionary.
So he went, and now Wajahat Ali has written about his experiences in the settlements in an article that appears today in The Atlantic. There's been a lot of blowback already since this article came out. Who tried to convince you not to go?
Everyone. That's the beautiful thing. I think I'm like the teetotaling Dos Equis man, the most interesting man in the world, because I've been called a Zionist faith-washing Trojan horse and also a gateway to jihad and a radical fundamentalist Islamist apologist. So I am your official unicorn radical Islamist Zionist faith-washing Trojan horse who at night moonlights as a gateway to jihad. And, you know, you have to have some dark humor about this place and this conflict, this occupation, and the people who live there do, because at times it can be maddening, but it's also cathartic. But some people are reading the piece, just hate reading it. Why are you with Jihad Ali going? Or if they read my name, they say, of course, it's a Muslimy-sounding name, so he's going to be anti-Israel and anti-Semitic and pro-Palestinian. And many Palestinian activists are saying, why are you going and telling this story? And you did not put enough Palestinian voices in there. And it's impossible for a 70-year conflict to be encapsulated in 8,000 words.
Well, if both sides are angry at you, then you're probably doing something right. Now, all this tension, you might wonder, like, why would you want to even live in a settlement? And that's what you put to Yisrael Medad. You actually went with a video crew on this trip. Medad is a resident of Shiloh Settlement. And you asked him, why would you live in a settlement? Here's what he said.
This is the symbol of returned, restored Jewish sovereignty. The land and the dream of the land is what makes us able to exist.
So Wajahat, this is clearly an existential issue for the settlers, tangled up with also a very powerful sense of home and powered by a biblical narrative. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, and the settlers are diverse. Many of them now say, listen, we're not driven by a religious motivation. We're driven there because there was affordable housing and we couldn't afford to live in Jerusalem and there's a great community and great education. Others, majority of them, are ultra-Orthodox who said they want a community of religiously observant Jews. And then there are those who have this type of religious zeal where they feel a deep attachment to the land and that God promised them this land and that the redemption of the land will bring about the fulfillment of the promise and the rejuvenation, if you will, of a modern chapter in Jewish history.
Yeah, you kind of got the extreme response from a resident of Hebron, Yishai Flesher, and you asked him whether being in the West Bank settlements was worth the bloodshed and the conflict. Here's what he said.
What you perceive as bloodshed and conflict, we see is actually the end of 2,000 years of bloodshed and conflict. Today, in all of the wars of Israel, it's less than 2 days at Auschwitz. Okay, so to us, we actually see a time of great peace.
But how do you reconcile that with Palestinian citizens of Israel? Can they be equal to Jews?
No, not in my opinion. I don't deny democratic principles. I just say that they have to yield, the yield sign, to Zionist Jewish principles first, and then, of course, cater to democracy. But that's not the first principle, in my opinion.
For you.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So Mr. Flesher takes it back to the Holocaust, and he also rejects equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel. Was he at all hesitant to tell you that?
No. Yishai, for what it's worth, was very blunt and transparent. He doesn't hide his views. And no one goes back to just the Holocaust. We take the DeLorean back. Some people took back 4,000 years. So Yishai went back.
Future reference, everybody.
Yeah, literally, Yishai went back the furthest. Some people take it 4,000, 2,000. Some people take it the 20th century. I mean, literally, it feels like when you go in Israel and Palestine, everyone, before they learned how to drink milk, they were taught law and can argue their case. And you go to, the, you know, 48 and 67 and then the October War and then Oslo. And then you're like, wait, you're only 4 years old. And so Yishai and others see redemption of the land. Glory. It's ours. It belongs to us. We're coming back. It was taken away from us. And anyone who wants to fight us, we're going to fight back. And Yishai has a big giant gun on his back pocket.
You say near the end of your story that you prayed for the settlers. What did you pray for?
Yeah, you know, I went, just my timing, Marco. When I went in the summer, there was the latest crisis, which resulted in violence. And when I first went to Al-Aqsa to offer my Friday prayers, they didn't let anyone under the age of 50 enter because apparently at 49, you're a terrorist, but at 51, you're a neutered kitten. But a week later, and just shows you how absurd the situation is, everything cleared up. In that same place, there was a brief moment of normalcy. And I got to go to Al-Aqsa to offer my Friday prayers. And I looked around the compound and I saw normalcy. I saw joy in life and kids playing with their soccer balls and moms gossiping and uncles. And I prayed. I prayed for everyone, the Palestinians. I prayed for people who I thought were extremists. And I even prayed for the settlers because I'm convinced that their zeal to redeem the land has transformed the land into a golden calf. It has become an idol. And I believe that they've placed it on this pedestal where God, morality, ethics, and now even democracy can barely reach it. I think that these settlements and the redemption of the land has become the Achilles heel of Israel and its security. That commitment to the settlement expansion project is going to come at the expense not only of the Palestinians who suffer, but also of, I really mean this, Judaism. I think it's going to come at a major cost. And people usually measure cost by lives lost, but sometimes that cost comes in the form of ethics in a nation's soul. And I say this as a person who does not want anyone to suffer or die. I say this in the article that I believe you need a solution where Jews and Palestinians each get something that they want. It's not going to be perfect. I don't think land, stones, or bricks are worth the single life or a drop of blood of a believer. And I mention a saying of the Prophet Muhammad in the piece where he saw the Kaaba in Mecca, the holiest site in Islam, and he looked at it with awe and reverence. But then he said, "The sanctity of a believer's blood and property in the sight of Allah is greater than your sanctity." And it, as a believer, if you will, as a Muslim, it pains me that we have put stones and bricks and temples, which can easily be replaced or destroyed, above the sanctity of life and morality and justice. Blame is to go around everywhere, of course, but I do not believe that the redemption of the land will bring about peace and security. And I hate how this occupation and this conflict has inspired the worst demons of our communities to rise. And I hope it can inspire the best angels to rise and to find some sort of mediation.
Writer Wajahat Ali, his article in The Atlantic, A Muslim Among the Settlers, is out today. Wajahat, thank you very much.
Marco, thanks so much, man.
And that's where we're going to leave it today. We'd love to hear from you. Tweet at us. We are at PRI The World. I'm at Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. Thank you so much for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.